All right, looks like we've got a pretty good crowd here for a late session. So thank you for coming to a 5 o'clock. Sometimes they can be lightly attended, so thank you. My name is Chris Hallam, and I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. And so what that basically means is if there's a security technology in Windows, that's that's probably my domain. If those features are also, when I say Windows, I mean Windows Client. If those features are also in Server, I would own that as well. So things like BitLocker, the biometrics, and things we're talking about today, that all falls under my domain. And so what we're here to talk about is what's new in Blue, and of course Blue is 8.1. Before I get into the talk, I had a number of sessions, and some of the content is in a little bit in all of them. So I'll just make sure, how many of you attended the keynote? So I can get in. So most of you, that's a really good number. Okay. So we're going to be talking about biometrics, but we're going to go into more detail. So you'll see some of the same demos, but we're going to have a lot more information about how that works so you understand it more. But there'll be similar demos. How many of you were in the session I just gave in the last hour about protecting clients against threats? Okay. So just a few. Okay. So a little bit of duplication there too, but not. So there will be new information for everybody, but some of the things will be familiar. Okay. So let's get into the deck here. Let me get the clicker. All right. So the agenda for our presentation here is we're going to talk about Windows 8 security, and we're going to talk about the achievement that we've made there and our goals. We're going to talk about the results. How much better is Windows 8 versus 7, for instance, is something we're going to help answer. We're going to talk about a changing threat landscape. The types of threats that we see coming are very different than what we've experienced in the past. They're not completely novel, but they are going to be executed at scale in the near term, we think. And so we're focusing our attention away from certain types of threats and looking at new ones. So we're going to tell you why. And then the last thing, of course, we'll talk about are, okay, what's new in Windows 8.1. So we got about 10 minutes of kind of what was 8 and how did we do, and then the rest of the session is all about 8.1. Okay. So when we think about security at Microsoft, our approach is, like everybody in this audience, you have a mental model on how you approach the problem you're trying to solve. And the way we solve security is by creating a series of pillars, a series of categories. And the categories of investment in Windows 8 were malware resistance, protecting sensitive data, and then authentication and access control. So those are the key categories. And so in Windows 8, from the very beginning of the planning of that project, our goal was to deliver the most substantial set of security improvements that we'd ever delivered in a single version of Windows. In fact, we were able to deliver as many improvements as we had delivered in, when you counted up, XP to XPSP2 to Vista and to 7. So all of that work we did in security, we delivered almost an equal amount in this one release. And this isn't because of some miracle, it's because we purposely staffed the project to enable that. And we did that because there were certain objectives that we wanted to achieve. And so, for instance, when it comes to malware resistance, malware has been a problem on the Windows platform in the past, and what we wanted to do is we wanted to change the game completely in Windows 8. In the past, we've delivered incremental improvements. We've made it harder and harder and harder. But we've never changed the game in the past. It's always been incremental improvement. With Windows 8, we provide groundbreaking malware resistance, and we do that by completely hardening the boot process. So all the way from power on, all the way to Windows sign-in, that is protected in a way that we've never had before. Malware can't start before Windows because we use UEFI technology to provide us with secure boot. And malware can't insert itself in the middle of the boot process, such as maybe installing a malicious kernel mode driver during boot to tamper with Windows, its defenses, and the anti-malware solution. So we've really blocked all those things off. And that's where the game change effectively happens, is that's where all the most malicious malware occurred, was in that area. There's still opportunities for malware in the future, but I think we've really blocked off the worst areas, or the most sensitive areas. We also secured the core itself in a way that was fairly dramatic. There were two technologies. One is called ALSR, and the other is called DEP. I'm not going to go into details what these features are, because probably many of you already know what they are. But basically, the nutshell is what these features do is they create the condition that even if somebody finds a vulnerability in Windows, the likelihood that they can exploit that vulnerability and deliver a malicious payload such as malware is dramatically lower than any previous release. We had ALSR and DEP in Windows 7 and Windows 8 and even Vista in some areas. But we never had applied it holistically across the system. We only applied it to very specific areas. And it's a long, complicated story on why we didn't apply it everywhere. But the short of it is, in order to put those technologies everywhere in Windows, we actually had to go back and change code that hadn't changed in 10 years in some cases. So some of the code in Windows 8 has never been changed. Well, now it has because of these features. But in 7, they had never been changed because we don't want to touch code unless it's broken, right? Because when you touch it, you need retested, and there's risks there. But because of the needs we had for malware resistance, we went and opened up the kernel again and made some dramatic changes. And so now we're more secure than ever against vulnerabilities. And in fact, the type of individual that it would take to attack the system, Windows that is, and to defeat ALSR in depth, it really requires maybe a team of people, top of the line, high IQ experts, versus maybe an individual who's very bright on Windows 7. It's magnitudes of order more difficult. And I think we have a statistic that I'll show you in a minute that proves that to at least be fairly probably true. The next thing we did to secure the system against malware is we have a new application model. In the old world, we had these things called desktop apps, and those will still be useful in the future, right? Their desktop apps have incredible power, but many of the apps that you're using don't need that power, right? Desktop apps have the ability to access the system. They have the access to your data. They have access to other applications. They can do pretty much anything they want as long as they have the sufficient privileges. In Windows 8, we've created the condition with app containment or sandboxing such that these apps do not have the ability to tamper with the system. They do not have the ability to talk to other applications except through discrete declarative actions that those applications share for use. And they do not have the ability to access any of your information on any of your data unless you go file open, for instance. So they don't have unfettered access to the file system where they may grovel and look for interesting information and steal it off of the device. So these apps are inherently more secure. And so when you put all these together, you really have a game changer, and I think groundbreaking malware resistance is a very fair statement. When it comes to protecting sensitive data, our goal is to make sure that every single device that you provision in your enterprise, or even at home, can be encrypted with top-of-the-line, commercial-grade encryption solution. In Windows 8, we introduced device encryption to the platform. And we included it in Windows Phone 8 and also in RT, but that's as far as it went, and that was automatically provisioned. And then we also had BitLocker in professional and enterprise, and our goal with BitLocker was to make it super easy to provision, right? Almost as easy as device encryption, which is automatically provisioned for you. Provisioning encryption with BitLocker, it could be, depending on the scenario, it could be 10 times faster, 20 times faster, 30, 50 times faster, all depending on the size of your image and the size of your disk. So if you have a 1 terabyte drive with a 30 gigabyte image, in Windows 7, we would have encrypted 1 terabyte of data. In Windows 8, we encrypt 30 gigabytes of image, and then as new data is written, we encrypt that. So you can imagine, do the math on how much faster the encryption process would be because of that. So that was another goal, make BitLocker encryption the easiest to provision and to make it pervasive on devices. The last category is modern access control. We need to modernize access. It's really been the same for as long as I can remember. In fact, when we think about securing the file system, for instance, let's imagine I have a file server. What do? We have an object, like a share that we want to secure, and I have a security group full of users, a list there, and I have a relationship between these things. And then somebody has to keep that list up to date. And you know what happens? Is it's not up to date. Is you have new users who come into your organization. They struggle with getting access to the resource. Who owns this file server? Who do I contact? How do I get access? And then as users move out of organizations and maybe where they should lose access to those resources, guess what? Nobody takes them out of security groups normally. In fact, I've been at Microsoft for 17 years, and I still have access to file servers that I should clearly not have access to. But it's always cumulative, right? Because people just don't have time to manage this. So we have a feature called dynamic access control that moves away from static lists to dynamic access control lists so that based on the user's properties, the department that they work in, the projects they are on, the manager they report to, the security clearance, all these different properties that maybe are in AD, we can use those as the criteria for access control. So as users are provisioned to the directory, guess what? They automatically have access to your shares. As they take new jobs and the properties in AD change, they lose access to the old resources, but they gain access to the new ones. So this is a superior way. This is a modern way of securing access to resources. In Windows 8, it's designed for file servers and for SharePoint, but we think that this has potential to grow beyond that. Imagine using it on a web server. We don't have that feature yet. That's maybe down the road in the future. So to be clear, it's for file servers and SharePoint in the moment, but I think it goes into other scenarios down the road. We also want to move people away from passwords. Passwords are increasing our problem, and they're increasingly the source of attack. As we make dramatic improvements to our malware resistance capabilities in Windows, attackers are moving away from malware, and they're looking at attacking your identities, because guess what? The humans have now become more easy to hack than the software. It's not always true, but it's oftentimes true. Users can be manipulated into giving private information that can be used to manipulate help desk into giving them password resets. Passwords sometimes can be guessed, although that is somewhat hard. But there's all sorts of ways that people are gaining access to your identity. And so that's something that we wanted to focus on. And with Windows 8, we delivered a new two-factor authentication option called Virtual Smart Cards, which allows you to use a virtual two-factor authentication option rather than a physical one that you use maybe today. How many people in the audience are using two-factor authentication in their organization? Okay, so maybe it's a third, somewhere between a third and a half. Okay, and so for those of you who raised your hand, how many of you use it on every single resource in your network? Everything's protected, every file server, every access point. Okay, it's like almost none, right? There's like five people in the audience who do that. And so the reason why is because it's too expensive and it's a big hassle. And it causes support challenges, and it goes on and on. So the cost of delivering a smart card to your users, which is a reader and a card, maybe it's $50. When the user forgets their smart card, and they're on an oil rig in the middle of the Gulf region in the United States, they can't get their job done. And so that costs you $100 an hour, $200 an hour of lost productivity, or whatever it is that a contractor on an oil rig gets. And so you can imagine your own scenarios. So you don't deploy it holistically because it's too challenging and too expensive. Virtual smart cards give you an electronically provisionable smart card capability, a two-factor authentication capability that you can provision electronically to users and improve the security, and it doesn't have all the challenges and hassles that you're experiencing with physical smart cards and CAC cards and all these other options. It requires TPM, so you need PCs that have the trusted platform module, because that's how we secure the virtual smart card. The virtual smart card itself is really nothing more than a certificate that represents your identity, and then Windows models virtually a smart card reader and a smart card itself that's always in the device, always plugged in. You can look in the device manager and see it, actually. And so this gives you two-factor authentication when connecting to remote resources, but for those of you who are savvy on security, you'll probably be thinking, oh, that doesn't give me two-factor on sign-in, and you are absolutely right. So if you need two-factor sign-in local, you need to use a physical smart card or some alternative. But if you're one of the five or whatever who didn't deploy physical smart cards everywhere, deploy a virtual smart card to all of your users and use the physical ones for the people who need that local sign-in. So you can use a mixed approach, and there are products from like Intercede, for instance, which is a management software. They can manage physical and virtual smart cards all together, and there are other companies as well. So that gives you a little overview of 8. And so we made huge improvements. These improvements are not entirely dependent on new hardware, but Windows is much more secure when you have a Windows 8 certified device, which always includes UEFI. So Universal Extensible Firmware Interface gives us a secure boot capability. It means that malware can't start before Windows. It means we have a secure root of trust in hardware. And then the Trusted Platform module itself is not required in Windows 8 certified devices. But it is in most commercial devices, and it's also in most tablets that we see today. And the reason why it's in most tablets is one of the great innovations in Windows 8 was that we can now use a firmware-based TPM. So we can use basically firmware to model a virtual TPM, and we can insert that into platform trust technology, which is an Intel capability. So it's a virtual TPM inside the platform trust technology, which is called PTT, is what most people know about it. And then if we're talking about ARM devices, like Windows RT or Windows Phone 8, we can put firmware TPM in the ARM chip in a component they call Trust Zone. And so Trust Zone and PTT have anti-hammering capability and all the characteristics of a smart card from a brute force protection perspective, and all the same characteristics as a discrete TPM from a security perspective. So while it's virtual and that might cause concern, is it secure, is it not secure, I can assure you that it is secure because the firmware is protected by something that is as secure as the TPM. It's just a slightly different implementation. So that gives you the story on Windows 8 security. And so let's talk about how well we did with the hero of the release, which was our malware resistance. That's where we think we made the biggest impact. And so this chart here describes the number of vulnerabilities across two key scenarios, or not vulnerabilities, the number of instances of malware on devices that we've been able to get information on in two scenarios. The first scenario is where the device was not protected with an anti-malware solution. So believe it or not, there are some Windows 8 devices that we become aware of through our program that have no anti-malware solution that's running or it's inoperable. And so why is that? Well, in some cases, some people have turned it off, literally. They've purposely done that. Sometimes developers do that for performance reasons, and so they live with the consequences of that. In some cases, they have a trial edition of a piece of software. Maybe it's McAfee or Symantec or Kaspersky. The trial edition has lapsed, and now they have an anti-malware solution that doesn't have recent signatures and is doing nothing. Oftentimes, these users think they're protected when they're not. So that's why we have unprotected PCs. And then, of course, we have protected PCs, which is where anti-malware is running. So let's look at the stats. The first stat is for every 1,000 PCs that we've found out about, 2.7 of them, when there's no anti-malware protection on, will have some sort of malware that we're able to find out about. If we look at Windows 7 SP1, it's about three times more likely to get malware with no anti-malware solution. So Windows 8 is, you know, at least three times better than 7 with no anti-malware solution. If we look at XP, it's about five times better. But when we run in the normal state, which is protected, it gets much better, of course. 0.2 for every 1,000 PCs would have some sort of malware infection on a protected PC. And with Windows 7, you're six times better off on 8. So six times is more likely to be infected. And then on XP, you're 21 times more likely to be infected until next year when XP hits end of life and the first vulnerability is found and everybody goes for it. And then you're going to be in a very difficult state with XP. So if you're one of those people who's still working on getting away from XP, I think when we don't patch that anymore, this could be a real problem. You're really going to have to be very diligent about moving away. That's what we need to do. And if you can't, you need to be protecting that perimeter, protecting the inside in a way that you haven't done before. So please move on to a modern operating system as soon as possible. Okay, so when we worked on the Windows 7 and 8 product cycle, it was actually both, we started to see a shift of attacks and a shift of thought in the people who were talking about the attacks of the future. People weren't as talking as much about deploying malware. They were starting to talk about just hacking people, stealing identities, and doing these types of things. And so as we moved into the future, we had to reassess the threat. And so this next couple of slides kind of, in somewhat dramatic fashion, kind of tee up what we believe is the threat landscape that we are in and are entering into. And so our view at Microsoft is there are really two types of organizations. There are those that have been hacked, and that's RSA, that's Microsoft, that's Yahoo, that's Apple, that's anybody that you can probably name who probably should never have been hacked, has been unable to defend themselves against very tenacious foes. So we realize we've been hacked at Microsoft, and we talk about it publicly, of course. But then there's everybody else. There's these people who just don't realize they've been hacked. And I'm not trying to say that 100% of our customers have been hacked, but it's a big number. If you look at SMB, small business organizations, there are stats that over 40% have had a network breach. And there's another statistic, which is that it usually takes them over 3 months to find out about it. And the way we found, the way Verizon, who put this report together, found out about that was by people who self-confessed to being hacked, and they then gave us this information. What about the people who never knew about it or won't admit it? right? I think that 40% number is really low. And so they're no longer going after Fortune 500. They're going after all these other people as well. And so in the last 10 years, there have been these very familiar threats that we've talked about. And for every new threat, there was a new mitigation. Then there's a new threat and the new mitigation. And it's just on and on and on. But now there's these modern threats that we need to get ahead of. They're very different than what we've seen in the past. And so let's compare the modern versus those familiar threats. And so the familiar is script kiddies, these people who are posers, in my view. They go to the internet and they find a hack that's on a web page and they use it and they think they're pretty clever. These guys are not sophisticated. We have cyber criminals who are sophisticated. They have computer science backgrounds oftentimes, but not always. But now the modern is we're dealing with cyber espionage and warfare. Right? We read in the news almost every day of really significant damaging attacks on Fortune 500 companies, on nation states, and there's attacks on smaller businesses too, as I've mentioned. So that's the modern. The cyber criminal of the past is a person who's going after maybe small amounts of money. Maybe it's in the hundreds of thousands. Maybe it's in the millions. In the modern, it's a cyber criminal who's going after tens of millions of dollars. They're going after huge, huge bets. And we're also talking about state-sponsored actors that are going after everything. They're not just going after U.S. government secrets. They're they're getting patient records. They're getting their hands on anything that they can. It clearly looks like there's a black market developing for all sorts of different types of information. If you're familiar with the Red October virus, Kaspersky wrote about it a while ago. This is a vacuum that is collecting everything. Not clear exactly what they're doing, but my guess is there's going to be a very, very prolific black market where information will be sold. We're familiar with software solutions to solve all security problems, but the modern is if you don't have the latest security hardware, we don't think that you're protected against the threats, these modern threats that are coming. You need to be thinking about upgrading to the latest hardware, hardware that has UEFI, hardware that has TPM. If you have a five-year replacement cycle, it's going to take a long time for you to get to a time where you have completely secure devices with this new hardware. Well, our recommendation is you should be looking at the users in your organization that have the data that's most at risk, the most likely targets, and you should accelerate the provisioning process of new technology to those users. We're very worried about them being targeted because that's what we see happening. And so we think that you should provision those people new technology faster than people who don't have that type of information that would be of interest. So we're familiar with securing the perimeter. We think you should assume breach and you should protect the perimeter, the client, the resources, the shares. Everything has to be protected, a new level of sophistication. We talked about this already. It's not Fortune 500 that's being attacked. It's everyone. And then the modern, of course. The last one here is for the familiars. I hope I don't get hacked. And the reality is you probably will be hacked if you haven't already. And it's really a question of how well have you mitigated against this. So here's a couple of quotes here just to really drive this home. This is F-Secure. Many of you know this organization. This is what they said in response to Flame. So F-Secure is a security group, if you're not familiar with them. They said that the security products that you're using today are not capable of protecting you against the digital equivalent of SEAL Team 6. SEAL Team 6, as you know, is the organization that went after bin Laden. They're the best there is, except in the country that you have, and then you have an equivalent that is equally good as SEAL Team 6. But these are the type of people who are attacking you. These are teams of sophisticated, full-time employees going after your IP, your information, and your money. This is the Verizon report that I mentioned earlier. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Verizon, definitely a big U.S. company. But what they said here is these people who think that they're too small to be targets, that they don't have anything of value, they are wrong. Small businesses are being targeted at scale. Last quote here came out about a month ago. You may be familiar with this. Some of the top secrets for NATO, some of the top defense secrets, things like the F-35, missile defense, name your favorite military system, a lot of the plans had been completely compromised. So this is a very big problem. And Lockheed Martin, who's one of the big defense contractors in the U.S., said this, and I find this particularly interesting. They said they're spending more time dealing with attacks on their supply chain than they are on themselves. They're protecting their suppliers, their contractors, their vendors, their employees. If you're building nuts and bolts for the F-35, you will be a target. Right? So don't think you're safe. All right. So moving forward, there are going to be two types of organizations. There are going to be those who adapt to this modern threat, and then there are going to be those who don't, and will pay some consequences. And I know I'm painting a bleak picture, but these attacks that we think are coming are pretty frightening, and we're seeing them already. You've already seen the news stories. So let's talk about Windows 8.1 improvements for the rest of the conversation. So we'll talk about each one of these in detail, but the big features in Windows 8.1 are biometrics. We're going all in on that. We're going to help improve PKI on the internet and also in your organization. We're going to make it more trustworthy. We're going to have a cloud-based service that's going to protect you against threats that can't be detected locally. So we're talking about sophisticated malware, malware that might be signed by a fraudulent Microsoft certificate that under normal circumstances might look like Microsoft but is not, because we think that eventually somebody will compromise SHA-1 and 2 and all these things. So we need a cloud-based service to deal with that. And then we have some stories around encryption and the ability to selectively wipe corporate data. So much of our story is dependent on TPM. So buying PCs with TPM is probably already happening in organizations because it's almost difficult to buy a PC that doesn't have one today. TPM technology will be moving into consumer tech devices later this year because of Haswell, as well as a new processor line from Intel. And we're going to make TPM a certification requirement starting in 2015 for all devices. So just next year, it's not too far away, not next year, but next year plus a few months, you're going to see every PC ships with a TPM. Maybe firmware-based, it may be discrete chip, doesn't really matter to us because from our view, we have a neutral view. They're equally good in our view. If you're doing business in China and Russia, or maybe you are from China or Russia, you're probably familiar with TPM situation there. Right? A lot of people believe that it's not allowed. And to some extent, that is true. Right now, we're in the process of working with those governments, and we believe that sometime in the very new future, and I don't have a date because we're not in control of these conversations in their entirety, we believe that China and Russia will officially sanction in a broad, publicly disclosed way that TPM can be used in those regions. We already have companies that are using TPM, have been sanctioned. They've gone through proper authorities to get the sanctioning and the proper paperwork so that their employees are protected. You should consult with your legal departments if you're doing business in there and you want to use TPM. But we believe in the near future that we'll see that broad public disclosure, and we think TPM will be allowed. We've already seen Lenovo shipping TPM devices into China. Of course, Lenovo has a special relationship there, so they were able to do that. So we already see the change happening. Okay. Let's talk about biometrics. So biometrics has been in Windows for several generations. It was in Windows XP and Vista and 7, but it's always been a framework. It always required that you went to a third party and that you got enrollment software to enroll your biometric identity, if it was a fingerprint or your iris or whatever. In Windows 8.1, we're optimizing for fingerprint-based biometrics, and we include all of the software that you need for authentication on resources and enrollment of your biometric identity in the box. So you don't need to go get third-party technology for this. Of course, you will need a sensor, so you're going to have to go buy that. But that's going to come in devices with greater regularity. This year, you'll start to see a ramp-up of more devices using swipe-based technology. I'm going to show you the new technology, touch-based controllers, and that will start to ship hopefully this year, but definitely next year you'll see a broad range of devices including this technology. Our goal is to move people away from passwords. I talked about virtual smart cards being a step. Phase two is biometrics. Let's get them to interact with their biometric identity rather than the password. And there's going to be a step that comes later where we're able to really eliminate passwords from the landscape. But there's a few more things we need to do. But we just keep on kind of chipping away at the password problem as we go forward. This will be equally good for consumers, and it's also designed for enterprise. So when it comes to fingerprints, which we're optimizing for, there's all sorts of choices out there. There's optical readers, and there's a bunch of others. Capacitive readers are going to be the ones that we're going to be seeing delivered to PCs. Capacitive readers don't have to deal with this problem. I don't know how many of you have seen this image before, but for those of you who haven't, this is an image from a newspaper article. Actually, it was a web article, but at any rate, about a set of doctors in Brazil. In this hospital that they worked at, had their doctors sign in with their biometric identity, their fingerprint. It's actually their thumbprint in this case. So when they get to work, they sign in, and when they leave work, they sign out, and that's how they get paid. Well, this group of five doctors decided that, things are kind of slow in the hospital. Why should I be standing around doing nothing? I'm going to go watch football, or I'm going to go to the bar or the beach or whatever is fun to do in Brazil. And so what they did is they created identical representations of each of their thumbprints. And three doctors would show up on shift, and they would sign in the other two who went and goofed off all day. And this is a real story. And these are right out of the case files. And so they had all these fake fingers. And so this was possible because they were using optical reader technology, which is inferior. It's like a scanner. It's like a photocopier of your fingerprint. And so it worked. The characteristics of a modern reader don't allow you to play these spoofing games, right? That's inferior technology. Capacitive readers have liveness detection. Thermal and ultrasound also have that. But liveness detection detect the difference between a finger that's full of life and one that is dead. The image you see here is a fingerprint of an individual who is deceased. This is what their fingerprint looks like, right? And the reason why it looks that way is they don't have moisture. They don't have life in them, right? Their skin changes. This is what a real fingerprint looks like if you were to take it today, unless you press your finger down, and then you would probably end up with the other finger. But it looks quite different. And so our sensors have algorithms to detect the difference. But they also have more than that. These sensors also have the capability to detect liveness in a broad range of other ways. They can inject electrical current and take measurements of the response times. There could be electrocardiogram-like capability, moisture. There's a whole broad range of different things that they can do to detect liveness. So if you think that spoofing is going to be a problem with this new technology, I can assure you that that is not the case. These new touch-based readers, these modern readers, are superior and secure. And that's why we're going all in on it now, because the technology is ripe and ready. This is an image of a reader from a company called Fingerprint Cards of Sweden. Many of you know this company. The sensor is a chip there, silicone, and I have another example I'll show you. That's USB attached, and you're going to see these attached to actually devices directly. There's a lot more that we can do with fingerprint biometrics than just signing in. We can also do buying, purchasing with it. So I can sign in with my biometric identity into Windows. I can log into my VPN. I can, I can elevate privileges with UAC. I can do anything in Windows. We now support all of that. But I can also use a touch to buy scenario. So when I go to the Windows Store, or I'm in an application that you develop that has the concept of in-app purchases, or I go to Xbox Live and Music, I can use my biometric identity to provide consent to the purchase. So it's verifying that it's me. And so this is pretty cool. If you've ever shared your device with your kids, you may be worried that they're going to go to the store and purchase something. Well, now the store is going to use your biometric identity to provide consent. So you maybe are going to feel a lot safer about handing your devices to your kids. My recommendation is you should give them their own profile, but I know that you don't always do that. So this is a pretty cool feature. We can also use it for another scenario. We can also use it to provide the ability to detect user presence. So when I log into my PC and I start using my applications, every one of those applications runs under my user context, and every one of those applications assumes that it's still me. But what we know is when I'm typing and it's about lunchtime, if I'm not thinking about security, maybe I just walk away from my device, and this device is now wide open to somebody to go up to it. Maybe steal information, maybe add themselves as an administrator. There are all sorts of terrible things that they might do. And so we can use biometrics to confirm the actual user presence in certain scenarios. So imagine that you have an application, like a banking application, and it has the ability to move money from one account to another, or it has the ability to trade stocks, right? Wouldn't it be great if you could use biometrics to confirm that, hey, this really is the user before that transaction happened? In addition, wouldn't it be nice that your auditing information doesn't just look like it might be the user, right, because they're logged in with a password, that you know for sure that it was the user, the real user, because they authenticated with their biometric identity to trade those shares, and you can trace it back to that user? These are the types of things you can do with it. In addition, you can also protect data as well with your biometric identity. So in the United States, once a year, we file our taxes with the government, and we have this horribly long form we have to fill out. It could be dozens of pages. It's very complicated. So we have this great software called TurboTax. Well, TurboTax collects all this information about me, and it is incredibly confidential. If somebody were to access that information, they could steal my identity. They could set up credit cards under my name. They might even be able to file for a mortgage of a home under my name. So this information is incredibly sensitive. So imagine having the ability in TurboTax or an application of some other type where that information can't be accessed unless my biometric identity is provided. These are the types of things we're thinking about in Windows 8.1. So biometrics is a lot more than just authentication. It's about authentication, consenting to purchases, and verifying user presence in scenarios where it makes sense. So let me show you just a couple of quick demos here. Let's see here. So the first thing I'm going to show you are some new modern sensors. So the one on the right here is from Fingerprint Cards. This is a USB attached device. It's a prototype. But the sensor in the middle that we're looking at is the point of interest. And I know it's hard to see because we're shining this bright light on a reflective surface. But I think you get the point. If you look at my finger here, you can see how small it is. By the time these go into production, these are going to be shrunk to 9 by 9 millimeters. This is a little bit larger than that. I don't have the exact dimensions, but they're going to be a little bit smaller than we have here. And you're going to be able to put this in the palm rest of a laptop. You're going to be able to put it on a tablet around the edge. You're going to be able to put it on a mobile phone, a keyboard, anywhere you think it makes sense. OEMs are going to innovate and put these sensors wherever is necessary. So this is, and again, this will start to happen this year, but really probably next year is when we really start to see these devices. The device next to it is a great technology as well. Isn't as pretty. The Fingerprints really did a great job engineering the casing here. But this has a similar technology. It's touch-based as well. This is from Validity of the United States. They're a biometric company. And so there's a number of other companies as well. There's Edgestack from Taiwan and then a bunch of others. So there's lots of people making these. And these devices here, these touch-based sensors, could be quite expensive in the past. I think they could be over $100, $200, maybe even up to $300 in some case, depending on the technology behind it. But now that we're including this first-class capability in Windows, the price of these are going to go down because these are going to be sold in the hundreds of millions. Maybe it's going to be billions, really. I mean, if you look at how many devices are being sold a year, we're talking about billions of devices. So the potential here is great. And so these are going to be very affordable very shortly. So let me just show you a quick demo of how good these sensors are. Oops. Gotta use the right one here. My PC went into hibernation mode there, so let me resume it. Okay. All right, sorry about that. Okay. So right now, I have a device, and this device includes a validity sensor, so the one I just showed you, the second one. They actually embedded this sensor into an actual device. If you're interested in seeing kind of what it looks like, you can probably imagine it pretty easily, but after the session here, you can come take a look. But the beauty here is that I've got my hands up in the air here, and so typically when you've used a swipe-based sensor, where I had to swipe maybe once or twice to get it to work, I could put my finger on the sensor, and in less than a second, I've already signed in. And so what's great about this technology in Windows 8 is Windows automatically detects that biometric identity. It finds the profile. And so I don't have to flip the lock screen. I don't have to select a profile. And I don't have to try a bunch of passwords to get in. It just knows who I am, and it just brings me into the right place. So from a user experience perspective, this is an amazing improvement, right? And this is why people are going to love the touch-based sensors, is because they're not swipe-based, which aren't very good, in my opinion. They're not going to have to go get third-party technology, and this is the most convenient way to access a device. So this is pretty awesome. I can also go up to the, I mentioned earlier, we can provide consent. So when I go to the Windows Store, and I go, let's say I want to go buy an application, such as Angry Birds. Today I go buy, I then confirm with my biometric identity, and in less than a second, I can make that purchase. So in that scenario where I've handed my tablet to my daughter and she's playing a game that we like to play together and she's logged on under my profile, she's not going to be able to go buy the next set of levels without me confirming and consenting to that purchase. So I feel a lot better about her using my device. But of course, because I'm a security guy, that never happens. I've created a special profile for her, and so she never logs on as me. But let me show you one more demo here. Let's see. So this is rounds. We showed this in the keynote, and it obviously it asks for my fingerprint-based biometric identity. The thing that I didn't have time to talk about before is that I have the choice to implement this anywhere I want in the application. I can implement it at app startup, so the app doesn't even start before I provide my consent to or verify my identity and presence before the app loads, or I can add it to functions within the app. I can add it to one function, I can add it to 100 functions. You can sprinkle this in the code anywhere you want. And if you're wondering about the code itself and how difficult this will be to implement, again, I showed this in the demo earlier, but I'm going to give you a little more sense of what the code really did since we have more time here. It's taking a minute to load here. Let me zoom in so we can see a little bit better. So here's the code. So some of you are developers. 25% of the audience, according to our stats, should be a developer. So you'll find this interesting. And for those of you who aren't devs, I'll help you follow along here. Let's see here. So the code here that I'm going to jump to is, if you remember, when we loaded rounds, we had two buttons, right? You had one for the nurse and one for the physician. So those are the buttons. What we're doing here is we're loading up the biometric capability here. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to confirm, as a developer, I don't want to ask for biometric identity without checking to see if the device is capable of biometric, right? So we know there's going to be a lot of devices that don't have these sensors for a long time. So you're going to handle that condition. So the first thing you do in your code is this device capable of biometrics? And two, are there any biometric identities registered on the device? And so that's what these first couple of lines of code do. It's these last four that are highlighted. Then this line of code here is where we load the biometric UI, right? So we say basically load biometric verification UI. And then if you see on the right-hand side there, you'll see some red text that says please. This gives you the ability to provide a custom message to the user. So when your user goes into an application and they suddenly see this pop-up saying give me your biometric identity, that might frighten them. They might go, why, right? Well, if it's about trading shares of stock, you can say before stock can be traded in this application, we require that you provide biometric authentication. And oh, by the way, to protect your privacy, just so you know, we're logging this with audit data, right, depending on how you want to handle that. So any custom message you want could be added there. So then we call the UI, and then we receive the biometric input, and then we handle the results. So if the biometric identity is validated, then we pass through in rounds and they get access to that patient record data. And if they don't, they get access denied. So you can add, as you can tell, all this code is cookie cutter, as we say in the US. It's almost a template. You can cut and pretty much paste this in your own. And there's very little customization that you'll need to add in your apps. You just need to decide where it makes sense to add and change a few things, like maybe that message that I showed you earlier. So really easy to implement, and so that's going to make it easier for you to add, and you can, of course, increase your overall security in your organization as a result. All right, let's get back to our presentation here, and let's go on to the next section. So there you have it. There's biometrics. So let's talk about virtual smart cards. So virtual smart cards, we talked about a little bit earlier, right, allows me to electronically provision a certificate that will be used as my identity to a device, and instead of using my username and password, I will use this certificate to access resources on the network. What we do, though, is we model that certificate as if it's a multi-factor authentication option. We model it like it's a physical smart card. So if you go to Device Manager, you'll see a virtual smart card and a virtual smart card reader. And so that's basically how virtual smart cards work, and we talked about it at length, actually, earlier on. What we've done that's new in 8.1 is we've made it so that it's easy to provision these cards to non-domain joined devices. So in Windows 8, very easy with the domain joined PC. With 8.1, it's now very easy to do it on a non-managed device. So we're really excited. So if you're in the banking industry, I'd be talking to people. It's like, hey, you know, once TPM is pervasive on our customers' computers, let's use virtual smart cards to authenticate them to their bank accounts instead of these terrible passwords that are being hacked all the time. And now you'll have a true two-factor authentication option. So this is really exciting, I think, for banking scenarios. It's got huge application for corporate scenarios. And it's very inexpensive to provision, as we talked about earlier. So that's the big difference, is non-domain joined devices, consumer devices can all take advantage of this now. So let's leap into a new area. This is a very exciting area for me, because some of the things that I've been working on in the past were related to PKI. And so one of the things that that's challenged us when it came to PKI is we've seen some famous breaches of trust in this system. There's a lot of discussion that, PKI is not trustworthy, right? Because it all depends on trust. And we can't trust this system. And so the reason why we can't trust this system is because of these four cases. And there's many more like it. But let me quickly explain what they are. DigiNotar was a certificate authority. They're now bankrupt. And the reason why they're bankrupt is somebody was able to call somebody at DigiNotar, and they were able to convince them to issue the private keys of Google, Yahoo, and a bunch of other companies. And then what happened later? Well, suddenly a series of servers showed up on the internet using these private keys. And then the DNS system on the internet was poisoned. And suddenly traffic was being routed to these servers. And these servers provisioned malware, stole identities, and created all sorts of pain for the users who got trapped there. And so because DigiNotar's only business was in keeping these certificates secure, they instantly went bankrupt because they obviously didn't know how to do their job. Very sad situation for those who worked there, because it probably was only a couple of people who enabled the whole company to collapse. But at any rate, these are authentic certs that have been stolen. Or actually, they weren't stolen. They were authentic. They were provisioned through fraudulent means to these users. Stuxnet is malware that you may be familiar with. That was used to attack a nuclear facility in Iran. In that case, they were able to get the malware into that organization by stealing the certificates from a couple of companies. So they actually got on premise, they stole the certificates, and they signed their malicious binaries, and those binaries then ended up in a nuclear facility, and that was an air-gapped network, right? So it somehow got in an air-gapped network where they had perimeter defense and all sorts of precautions, and it still got in there. They were, of course, very surprised, and then they got surprised again by Flame, and Microsoft got surprised by that too, because of those of you who are familiar with the Flame attack, that was a case where a Microsoft certificate was compromised, slightly different way. They weren't stolen off-premise, but somebody used what they call a collision attack on a weak algorithm, which was MD5 at the time, and they were able to recreate an authentic-looking Microsoft certificate, and then they signed the software. And then, of course, this was used on the same Iranian nuclear facility. So Flame is problematic for Microsoft, because that was we're the ones who kind of got hacked at the same time. But anyway, this was hacked cert scenario. And the last scenario is Mimikatz. Mimikatz is used to steal the certificates off of your device. So we talked about virtual smart cards and how let's provision a digital identity that represents you to your device, and you'll use that instead of usernames and passwords. Well, Mimikatz might be a tool that in the past would have been used to steal that. And once they've stolen that identity, they can replay that on their own devices, they can share it with their friends, and they can breach your network with that. Now, virtual smart cards are protected by TPM, which means that they can't export that certificate. So we protect that. So your virtual smart cards are secure from Mimikatz. They can't be exported. But there are a lot of certificates that are being used on your devices today that are not protected with TPM. And so the idea of exporting certificates and replaying them, we think that people are going to use this type of attack more frequently in the future. So those are four famous attacks that have caused us to lose a little bit of trust with PKI. And so what are the assumptions with PKI? The assumption with PKI is that your certificates that you have never been compromised. But based on the last slide, we know that they will be, or can be, at least. And so what we want to do, the opportunity for Microsoft, is to instill new trust in this system by delivering two new capabilities. The first capability is going to be to protect the certificates, your digital identities that are provisioned to you. So when you join the domain, your domain controller issues a certificate that represents your device identity. You also have a series of other certificates that are provisioned to your device as well. Those certificates can, just like the virtual smart card I talked about earlier, on a TPM-equipped PC can be protected by the TPM. And what that means is the TPM is used to encrypt those certificates and those keys, and then those keys can't be exported because they can't be decrypted except on the device itself. Once they leave the device with Mimikatz, they can't be decrypted. Only the TPM can do that. So we bind the certificates to the PC. But then we do something in addition to it, and we call that TPM key attestation. What this does is when that certificate comes to your PC, it's going to have extra metadata on it. That metadata is going to tell us that that certificate was provisioned to that device, that it was securely provisioned, and it was securely stored using the TPM. So we know that all the way from the issuer to the device that it was issued to, that we know that it's secure. The TPM protects it. And then what we can do is we can add access policy, maybe on your VPN server, that can say, I only trust this digital identity, these certificates that users may try to use to access the VPN, if that certificate can be proven that has been TPM secured. So if somebody was able to get your certificate in some way, it was not protected by TPM. Let's say you had a non-TPM device and it had your certificate, and it ends up on another device because somebody used Mimikatz, your RADIUS server, for instance, could deny access, even though that's a perfectly good certificate, because that service will be configured to not trust non-TPM protected certificates, it would deny access. So this is a pretty cool scenario that we think people will add to their networks in the future. I think there will be a time when everything in your network will be protected with this. I think that in the short term, people will maybe use it on their VPN connections, and they'll grow it out and mature it over time across everywhere. So we also want to add trust. So that's more of the public or private trust. That's the corporate certificate world. What about the public certificate world? So we mentioned DigiNotar a few minutes ago. They had certificates that were fraudulently acquired from them. How can we clean up that scenario? Well, we're going to release a cloud-based service. It's actually available right now in, with RP here. It's now harvesting information. And what this service is going to do is it's going to crawl the top 1 million websites on the internet. It's going to collect all these certificates, and it's going to collect effectively two key attributes. There's a lot more to it than that, but there are two key attributes that we want to look at. One is, where was this certificate issued from? Was it issued from the Google servers that we know about today? Or was it issued from a new server in Dagestan? That would be very interesting to know about. So this server is going to find out, or this service will find out, where these certificates are being issued from. And if we see anomalies in where certificates are being issued from, we're going to be able to investigate this issue. And we're going to be able to find out what to do next. That might be revoke the certificates. Now, if it was Google certificate, of course, we can't revoke their certificates. Only the certificate authority could. But we could inform Google, or we could inform Apple. We could say, hey, this is what we're seeing. Why don't you go take action on that, if that makes sense? And then they could let us know, oh, yep, we've set up a new data center in Dagestan. Makes perfect sense, right? So this is the part one. Part two is with the composition of the certificate itself. When we look at the certificate from a high-level view, if we quickly look at certificate, it might be looking authentic, but if we look closely at it, we might be able to see that it was created in a fraudulent way. That flamed scenario where they used the MD5 collision attack to recreate our certificate, we can analyze that certificate and see that it was not legit. But it takes a very close inspection to do that. So as we collect these certificates and we start analyzing them, we will be able to find anomalies. So when somebody cracks SHA-2 down the road, if that ever happens, or some other algorithm is being used, we're going to be able to detect that type of kind of malicious behavior. And so, and then we'd use the same remediation process. Inform the stakeholder, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, whatever, recommend a course of action that they can choose to take or not. So this is going to clean up the PKI space, and we think that this is about getting ahead of the threat that we think is coming, where people are going to go right after these websites. They're going to go right after our digital identities. They're going to steal these things. And we think that's the big new thing that we think that people are going to try to do. They're doing it with passwords. But if we move away from passwords and we get to virtual smart cards and other options, some of these issues will be less an issue. And these features will become even more relevant, actually. Okay. Let's talk about a new area. So we've talked about modern access control. Everything there is about modernizing authentication access control. Let's talk about protecting sensitive data. So we have two key features here. In Windows 8, we delivered a feature called device encryption, which is automatic commercial-grade encryption like BitLocker on Windows RT and also on Windows Phone 8. So when you turn on that device, automatically you have full volume encryption, your data is secure. And so that was a great feature, and our customers said, we love that. Push that down into every SKU, because we have consumerization happening. We have users bringing their own PCs that are not running Pro, they're not running Enterprise. We have bring your own device. We have all these challenges there. We just put encryption on these devices, and so that's what we've decided to do. Device encryption will be in every single edition of Windows, and it will be automatically provisioned if, and this is the key caveat, if the device is configured architecturally to be connected standby. So many of you do not know what connected standby is because we haven't talked about it much. Connected standby was recently renamed, like a week ago actually, to Instant Go. So it's going to take some time for everybody at Microsoft to align on this new terminology, which is why I'm giving you the two terms. They both mean the same thing. What connected standby is a mobile phone-like power management capability for your PC. Some of the tablets and the device bar that instantly turn on and off, they're always on. They're like your iPad and they're like your mobile phone. They're always turned on. That's trickling down from tablets into laptops, into convertibles, and into all-in-ones, and into desktops starting almost effectively now. Next year, you'll see this happening at scale, but already because of Haswell, you're going to see connected standby laptops and stuff probably shipping this year. So this is great because the connected standby devices are more secure, and here's why. They always include UEFI, they always include TPM, it's a requirement, and they do not have DMA ports. So DMA ports, which give you direct access to memory and create the condition where devices are susceptible to cold boot attacks, you can't have those ports on those devices. So these are very secure from a encryption perspective, and for this reason, connected standby or InstaGo devices do not need pre-boot authentication. So if you're using pre-boot authentication with BitLocker or you're typing in a PIN, when you move to your tablet, you don't need that because we only need pre-boot authentication to defend against a cold boot attack. And when you look at tablets, the memory on the device is soldered to the motherboard. There's no ports to attack it. It's kind of a complicated subject. We could talk about it for 15 minutes. But if you think you need a PIN on a tablet, you do not. And we've designed it that way on purpose. And that's what connected standby, in part, was all about, in addition to power management. But at any rate, connected standby devices always will have this capability. If you have a device that is not connected standby, this feature, device encryption, will not be enabled on that device because it just doesn't have the capability that we require. So the thing that makes device encryption different than BitLocker is management. It's really only one thing. The encryption itself is identical. BitLocker is actually the runtime for device encryption, so it's exactly the same. There's nothing different. The only difference is with BitLocker, I could add a PIN for a desktop computer that is susceptible to cold boot attacks. I could add additional protectors. Maybe I want to use a startup key that I use to plug into the device to boot. I may want to do enterprise management. I may want to centrally store recovery keys. I may want to do centralized reporting. Those type of management scenarios require BitLocker, but as far as the security of the encryption goes itself, it's equal from an encryption standpoint. So this is good news. The next feature here I want to talk about is a feature, I'm going to skip this slide here, is called selective wipe. So one of the challenges that you have in your organization is, especially with BYOD and non-domain joined devices, is when your corporate data lands on that device, when somebody connects to the VPN and they go to the file server and they get some corporate data, you've lost total control of that data, because it's an unmanaged device, and they own that data now, right? You probably have very little that you can do about that leaking further, et cetera. So what we've done is we've introduced a feature in Windows 8.1 called Selective Wipe. And many of you are familiar with this because this is an industry term. Selective Wipe basically creates the condition where the server where the data comes from can request that that Windows encrypts the data with EFS, and then we create a key that encrypts and decrypts the data. And then when you choose to remove the data from that PC, you can remotely issue a wipe command, and it will render the data inaccessible. It will destroy the keys, and it will leave the data behind. Or if need be, the application can choose to delete the data. We leave the data behind and don't delete it automatically. Because if we deleted it automatically, and you were using some file share replication service, what would happen is that delete would replicate to your cloud, and it could affect many users, and it may actually lose the only copies of the data you have. So it's up to the application you use to make the decision to delete the data. We don't do it by default, but if it makes sense, the application can. And an application where it does make sense is Mail. So Mail, which is the application in Windows 8 for receiving corporate mail and Hotmail and these things, has the capability to delete the data when it comes down. There are two applications in 8.1 that can take advantage of this feature. The first is the Mail app that I just mentioned, and the second is a new feature called Work Folders, which is a great new technology to replicate corporate data between PCs. It works for non-domain joined devices, so it's awesome for BYOD, and now you can wipe that data off of those PCs. So maybe you don't need to give them VPN access to your file servers, and they can use this Work Folder feature instead to get that data that they should have on those devices. So this is a cool feature. The data can be wiped using EAS, which is what you've used to wipe data in Mail in the past. And then there's a new management protocol called OMADM, which is a very rich protocol, which will allow MDM solutions, such as Mobile Iron and these others, to manage Windows devices for the first time. It also can be used to delete and wipe this data as well. One thing I should mention about the Mail app is some of you may be thinking, oh, well, Mail already had the wipe command. I've used EAS to delete that command or that data. This is true. The difference with selective wipe versus 8 was at 8 that data was not encrypted. So when you wiped the data was deleted, but I could go use Dart from MDOP and I could go recover that file from the file system, because technically you don't really delete files unless you do a format of the disk, really. You just delete the register out of the file application table. So you can resurrect these files using tools. So it's really not a secure wipe on 8. With Windows 8.1, it is a secure wipe because we encrypt the data and then we delete the key. It's never recoverable. And better than that, if you have mail and you have attachments in those mail and they are saved outside of the container, that encryption follows the data as it leaves the container. On Windows 8, if you save your documents outside of mail, you've lost total control and they do not get deleted by wipe. So much improved here down the road. And so we think that DLP solutions, which are full-fledged data loss protection or prevention features, will leverage this capability to improve their solutions and improve their performance. But I want to be really clear. Selective wipe is not a DLP solution, right? It is a solution that will give you more control over your data. If you want to truly prevent leaking of data through email or through USB, this is not that feature. You need to continue to look at DLP solutions to do that. But this is something that you could use, and most people don't invest in full-fledged DLP, so this might be at least the first step towards getting there and keep your data more secure. So let's talk about the last two features, and then we'll have some time for questions. Mail resistance. There's two main features here. The first feature is called provable PC health. In Windows 8, we gave you secure boot and trusted boot and measured boot. We gave all these great features to help keep the system secure. But there are certain conditions where malware may be able to defeat those systems. A scenario where that could happen is Flame. So what happened with Flame is somebody duplicated our signature using that collision attack we talked about earlier, and they signed a Windows OS loader, and guess what? Because it's signed and it looks authentic, UEFI, Trusted Boot, would think that everything's happy, and that system would boot, and Trusted Boot would never know it, and then you would have a PC that is owned. Now, Flame is a very, very sophisticated attack, so we don't anticipate a lot of these, but we know that these nation states and these large, well-funded crime rings might try to do the Flame of the future. So where we can solve this problem is we can do remote analysis of these PCs to find these local infections that an anti-malware solution wouldn't be able to detect once the PC is infected. So how does that feature work? Well, we'll have a client that ships with Windows 8.1 that will, on a periodic basis, harvest what we call measured boot data, which are integrity measurements of all of the boot components of the PC. The firmware, the option ROM firmware, the Windows boot files, the anti-malware solution. Also, all the kernel mode drivers will be measured, and the status of all of your security components in Windows, your firewall, your anti-malware solution, all of those will be collected. They will then be sent to the cloud for remote analysis. And if we are able to determine that you have a fake bootloader, such as Flame, right, we would be able to inform you. And so what would happen is the cloud receives the data, it analyzes it, and if a response is needed, we send data back to the client and indicate that your machine is infected. Here's how we remediate the situation. A virus of this nature may require a push-button reset, where we effectively wipe the OS and do a clean install. These are very sophisticated, very terrible viruses. It could also mean you need to boot to a clean operating system via USB. Maybe you have to format the PC and rebuild it, right? Because these are for the most notorious, dangerous viruses. If we determine that the malware on the PC has the ability to compromise your digital identity, let's say it's a keylogger or something that we know is designed to steal your identity, we're going to let you know about that, and then you will then know that you need to go through a remediation process to reclaim your Microsoft account and maybe other accounts as well. So your LinkedIn account, your Facebook account, maybe everything's compromised potentially with a keylogger. And so we'll let you know that that's the risk that you're now facing. This feature is designed for consumers, and it's designed to improve the BYOD scenario where you do not have tight management on the PC. This does not have enterprise management included. That's something that we're seriously looking at for the future. But this detects the type of viruses that you can't detect with your own software. This can only be done with a cloud-based service. And so while you may be tempted to turn this off because you don't have the reporting you want, I recommend you keep it on, because this is going to detect a virus that is terrible and you probably can't detect. So we highly recommend that you think very seriously about keeping this service in play. Last feature worth mentioning is improvements to Windows Defender. Windows Defender now has network behavior monitoring. So we're now able to look at common patterns of malicious behavior, and we're able to detect malware variants based on previous malware experiences, and we can detect and block that malware without provisioning new signatures to the device. So if we see a familiar pattern of behavior, we can block that malware and clean up the PC from there. So new, novel, innovative malware very likely can't be detected with this. This is about dealing with the reality of malware, which is there's one malware that turns into a new variant again and again and again and again. It's the same core, but it's a new look. It's a new dressing on the old hack. So this will be very effective at dealing with malware variants and polymorphism, potentially. Last feature here is I listed it as Internet Explorer. It's really a Windows feature. Windows now has an API that allows Internet Explorer, Chrome, Firefox, any browser, to have the anti-malware solution analyze the code that's sent to the binary extension. So today, when you use Windows 8 and Internet Explorer or Chrome, you go to a website, or actually, let's skip Chrome. Let's just talk about an IE scenario with Internet with ActiveX. When I go to a website, I receive a set of code from the website. I then pass that to the ActiveX control. It then executes, and if it's malware, then I have a big mess, and hopefully the malware solution will clean it up. So we basically are very reactive to the malware. What we've done is we've added an API so the browser can call the anti-malware solution to scan the source code coming down before it's executed. And so this is kind of an obvious feature. I don't think it's particularly innovative in its design, but it's something that we weren't able to get to in the past. So this will really help clean up the system of ActiveX controls and other binary extensions. So there you have it. That concludes the presentation, and I hope that you can see that Windows 8, we delivered a very thick layer of new security improvements to deal with these modern threats, the modern threats being identity theft, etc. We continue to make improvements in malware resistance, and I think Provable PC is pretty dramatic improvement there, but I think you can see what's happening there. We're starting to deal with more and more sophisticated threats with our software solutions, because our system has become more malware-resistant. And so it's almost funny. We're actually creating features to go after the 0.01% of the types of attacks, at least in malware. We're now focusing our sights on identity theft. So with that, if there are any questions, we have 6 minutes on the clock, but there's no sessions after this, so I can stay a little longer. So I'll take any questions at this point. Go ahead. What are the server requirements? Let's see here. So the server requirements are very little, actually. So today when you, for instance, in the case of the Exchange, for instance, Exchange doesn't require any changes. So when that mail comes down, what's going to happen is it's going to use EAS protocol, which says when the data comes to the client, it must be protected. And the client actually does all the encryption work. So the server actually doesn't really have any relationship in the story as well. Now, where it would have server requirements is in the second scenario, which is workplace work folders. Work folders is a server, the new version of server. I forget what the version. Oh, Server 2013 R2. That's an R2 feature, and so in that case you would need that. But beyond that, it doesn't really have any server requirements. None. No changes required for Exchange because we already had the plumbing we needed. So we had the protocol EAS. We had the device wipe policy, and so now what happens is the client now responds to the policy in a new way. Rather than it just wiping the data when the wipe command comes, it now says, oh, when I receive the data, I encrypt it. So it's all client-side work, which is great because now you don't have to do anything on the server side. Yeah. Question on the far end there. How can you trust TPM? Okay, so the question is, how can I trust TPM? And now I have a question for you so I can better answer it. What concerns do you have about the trustworthiness of TPM? What's the scenario? that's a good point. So one of the concerns that I encounter, because I work with defense in the United States all the time because they're very concerned about security, is they have this notion of the trusted foundry. How do I trust? And maybe the terminology is different in different languages, but what a trusted foundry is a foundry is a place that builds silicone. And so if somebody can build silicone, they may tamper with the design of the silicone. And then how do you know if you trust it? And so in the United States, the Dell and other OEMs, when they do purchasing, or not purchasing, but when the Department of Defense does business with them, they request specifically that the parts are sourced from a trusted foundry. So they negotiate this with the OEM and they make sure that these parts come from that. In the case of Germany, is an example, Germany and Infineon is a German company. And so they are going to be considered a trusted foundry for Germany and also others as well. And so the question is a difficult one to answer because, like, do I really trust Infineon? You know, how do I know I really trust that? There's a certain point where there is a leap of faith. And so you need to know where these parts are being sourced from. There should be vendors that you choose to trust. If you don't recognize the vendor of a TPM, I would not purchase the PC. And so I would definitely, as I'm purchasing PCs, find out the origin of the TPM and make sure it comes from a company that you believe is trustworthy. But if we talk about really serious spy stuff, you know, I don't know what governments might be able to do in those companies. They work in the shadows, and there's lots of news about that. So that's probably as far as I can go with that one. I'm sorry. Did that help at least a bit? Hardly. I'm sorry, but anyway, it's a good question. Very difficult to answer because who do you trust? Microsoft's not going to assert these are the trusted foundries, because that would be a huge liability to our company. So there's a certain point where the people you do business with, you need to develop the relationships and decide who's trustworthy and who's not. And that's something that individuals have to do it eventually. There is certification. So the part comes from the Trusted Computing Group. There's a specification that requires that the part meet all these components. There's a very detailed spec that you could look at if you choose to. I wouldn't look at it myself, although I have to because it's my job. But that spec has to be adhered to, and so you could gain some level of trustworthiness based on the certification of those parts. But I think there's always a potential for something else to be going on. Okay, next question. Uh, So it's critical to the design that that we don't allow your biometric identity to leak. There are a number of different ways that it can be protected. I believe that this device, and confirm if I'm wrong, protects it locally. It's hardware bound. Is that true? Okay. So in the case of the fingerprint card solution, your biometric identity is actually persisted in the hardware itself. So that makes it very secure. There are alternatives to that as well, that your biometric identity could be protected with the TPM. So the TPM itself could protect the digital identity as well. And so that could be, depending on, you know, you could have a philosophical debate, but I think that's a very secure way. But our goal, our design goal is that your digital identity, your biometric identity, I'm sorry, should never be compromised because it's non-revocable. So you can never, once this is in the public sector, you're in trouble. it has to be enrolled, yes. In fact, let me show you, actually. That's something I forgot to do. Oops. The machine keeps on going to sleep on me, so here we go. All right, so let me sign in. All right, so I used my finger to get in, so it was very fast. Let me show you the enrollment experience. So this is something that you had to go to a third party before, and every third party had a different way of doing it. Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry about that. Thank you for letting me know. Okay, so we go into our settings, go under accounts, and sign-in options for my account. And so in the past, you always went to the third party to get this, and every third party implemented a different way. And I was actually surprised how confusing these people made it. It was very, everyone that I saw was very difficult. But at any rate, if I want to enroll another finger here, I've registered so many fingers here, I'm going to have to go to my left hand. If I try to register the same finger twice, it's going to let me know. So I'm going to pick a new finger that I've never tried. First thing I need to do is before I enroll a new identity, it's going to confirm that I'm actually me. Right, because we don't want to make sure that I don't walk away from my PC and somebody sneaks in and adds their biometric ID to my PC. So it's going to confirm with an admin that I'm present. So I'm going to sign in with my identity. And now I'm going to enroll a new identity by putting my finger on the sensor. And it's going to scan it a number of times. You saw it scan it about 5 times. That's all based on the driver. The driver work can turn it into a 2-scan process, but this driver is a prototype. So it's actually, this driver is for their swipe-based reader, which requires about 5 tries. So this will get improved. It'll go to 2. But now I have a new identity. So I now have, I think, about 9 of my own fingers enrolled on this device. So good question. Any more questions? Question right there. Go ahead. Yeah, so this is an excellent question, and that seems like a natural evolution to the features. So the question is, maybe can I do remote attestation with it or something else like that? So provable PC health in its current version, right? It's a lot of back-end infrastructure and a consumer focus and a BYOD focus. In the future, we'll add additional capabilities. I can't disclose what's next. In fact, I actually don't know what's next. I know what could be next because it's guessable, but I'm not privy to the plans, but I think the ability to harvest that data so that you could make access control decisions on your network, either on your VPN or to file servers. So in other words, if the provable PC health status on the client indicates that it's not healthy, I do not allow it to connect to VPN. I do not allow it to connect to a file server. I deny access is a very interesting idea. We don't have that yet. That's something that I would like to see happen because I think it makes perfect sense. The question is, who would deliver that? We're still discussing. Is that something that a third party like McAfee delivers, or is that something that Microsoft should do? And so we're still talking about it.
We are
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think we can enhance the current capability to do that. However, if you wanted to do this in your organization, did you say you banking industry? Okay. So what I would do is there's two types of organizations I think might look at this feature. I'm going to tell you about in a minute. So banking and government and defense. So because you have assets that are need to be secured, and you're very worried about, you know, large sums of money being stolen or very important secrets being stolen. And so there's the concept of remote attestation. And so you can implement remote attestation, which basically is a situation where the client connects to the network and it harvests all its measured boot data, just like provable. It does all the provable PC health things. And then it sends to a service on your network. Maybe it's on the edge of your network if you want to do internet banking and these types of things. It then analyzes that data, and then it sends what we call a claim. And claim is kind of an industry term. So there's device claims, user claims. There's other types of claims. The claim indicates the health of that device. It sends it back. And then when you connect to your bank account, the bank account would say, show me your claim. And then if the claim is healthy, then access to the account would occur. And if it's not healthy, access would be not denied. You can work with Wave Systems. A U.S. company implements a remote attestation service that could be deployed in your network that maybe would enable you to do that. That's packaged software. I have a number of defense agencies that are working with solutions integrators to build very, very custom solutions for them. So there's General Dynamics. There's a long list of others who are doing this. So that might be something that you might consider. But however, I think in a couple of years, we're going to see Symantecs and McAfee's building this stuff. So if you want to do it now, I've given you some options. If you can wait a few years, I think you'll see better options available in the marketplace. Very good. Question right here. So the question is when selective wipe occurs, is the data securely wiped so it can't be undeleted? And the answer is yes. And so the way it's securely deleted is a little different than you might think, though. So what happens is when selective wipe, when the data comes to the PC, the client encrypts the data using EFS, and the key is stored in the credential locker. And so when the wipe command comes down, we destroy the key. It's completely unrecoverable, and you're left with encrypted, never to be decryptable data. There's no central store of those keys. It's gone forever. I'm sorry? 20 years? Sure. Yeah. It's possible. In the moment, yeah. That key cannot be recovered, no. Yeah. I mean, with enough time, everything will be hacked. So I think it's a valid point, but I think in the moment we can say this is a pretty secure thing. I'd say it's pretty secure. I mean, it's 256-bit encryption, so it's very secure. Question? Any more questions? Excellent question. So the question is related to maybe I move a disk drive to another PC that has a different TPM. Would that data be accessible? Maybe. Mm-hmm. It isn't. So one of the beauties of TPM is encoded with a unique identifier. If you change the fingerprint scanner, okay. So there's two scenarios here. So scenario one would be, do I have a hardware solution that stores my biometric identity on itself? So in that case, the TPM's not in play. If you removed the fingerprint reader and put a new one in because maybe it wasn't functioning, you would have to re-enroll because those identities would not be on the new one. There'd be no way of transferring them because they're bound to that device never to leave. So if you replace the fingerprint reader with a new one, you need to re-enroll. If you're using hardware solution, that's part one, or scenario one. Scenario two is if I don't have that level of sophistication in the hardware, if I'm using, well, that's the wrong way of saying it. If I don't use that scenario to protect it, if I use TPM to protect my biometric identities, if I was able to move the physical data where, because at the end of the day, it's data on the drive, right? If I was able to move that to another PC, could I decrypt that data? The answer is no. Only the original TPM that was used to encrypt that data can ever decrypt it. That's the design. So you can't move the disk to another PC and have it decrypt. Impossible. Without it, hacks that we're not aware of yet. I feel there's another question. Is there a follow-up or? Okay, all right. All right, any more questions? Okay, I think that's a wrap. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I hope you learned some interesting things, and I look forward to seeing you next year with maybe some new technology. Thank you.